Welcome to the May 16th meeting of the Ferndale City Council. Please rise with me for the salute of our flag.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Please be seated. We will now have the roll call.
Councilmember Czar.
Here.
Councilmember Hanson.
Here.
Councilmember Olson.
Here.
Councilmember Taylor.
Here.
Councilmember Watson.
Present.
Councilmember Birch.
Here.
Councilmember Goodrich.
Here.
Thank you. We are all here. At this time in our meeting, we have public comment. This is your opportunity to talk to your city council on anything that's on your mind that is not on today's agenda. If you're uncertain what the agenda is, we have extra copies up front here. You get 3 minutes. Please introduce yourself and who would like to be first today. If you are a student, I'm told you get extra credit for this, so we would love to have you. Come on up. I see a hand there. You can be first. Oh, you're just waiting.
Identify yourself as a hungry student.
So seeing none? Okay, I knew that would get you the move. Mr. Robinson, come on up, sir.
I'm still Papa John, and I still live at 6072 Malloy, Malloy Adult Home, that's adult with you. And I have first, remember I like to do horizontal and vertical kinds of things. Tonight the horizontal thing is a couple options where it's just puns for fun, and I'm going to read some things I have down here. The worst thing about a popular song is that it makes everybody think they can sing. If you are a complete pessimist, does that mean that you're positively negative? Politicians, now you'll love this one. Politicians didn't invent crime, they just improved on it. It's not easy to get a parking ticket nowadays. First, you have to have a parking place. This guy was so unpopular that when he called, his answering machine hung up. Not a good idea. And then the serious part of it. Now, this has both a literal and a figurative meaning. We don't see, well, back up for a minute. Most of you would know, some might think about it, that the sun shines 365 and a fourth days a year, 24 hours a day. And so if somebody asks you that, now you know the answer. But the point is, the reason why you don't see it is one of two reasons. And this has a spiritual application as well. Now, when I say sun here, I'm talking literally about the S-U-N, figuratively about the S-O-N. Okay. You don't see the sun, the S-U-N, or the S-O-N, for one of two reasons. You've moved away from it. Now, true, in this case, you're moving away at 1,000 miles an hour, not even knowing it, because that's the way the world turns. The second reason is because there's something between you. Literally, it would be clouds, or fog, or something of that. Figuratively, in one case, talking about the S-O-N, the reason why you don't see him is because you choose to walk into darkness. It's your choice. You've moved away. Or if you don't see him well and you want to, it's because you've allowed something to get between you and him. Food for thought.
Thank you, Mr. Robinson. Anyone else would like to speak to the city council? Come forward. Mr. Callum.
I have two issues or two things I'd like to talk about. One is the thing with Transco, you guys are going, that road you're going down, my question...
And we could let you speak on that when we come to that later in the meeting. Would that be okay if you're going to be here?
Well, I just had two quick questions.
Your choice.
One is, you know, what's it going to cost and what's the time frame when they're going to deliver?
And I'm sure they'll be answered by our staff at that time. Good questions.
The other issue that I wanted to talk to you about is you guys have a water project that's out to bid right now. City of Ferndale standards call for ductile iron pipe. There's a thing called C900 class PVC that's used in the city of Seattle. It's used all across the country, and it's completely duplicates ductile iron as far as all the fittings and all that stuff goes. I mean, it's a really great product. I sent everybody an email on that earlier this afternoon. I don't know if you got it, but it was just a little while ago. But it's a great product. The deal is like the price of oil is way down, so it's like The last time I priced it, it was like $10 a foot less money. So if you got 6,500 feet of pipe you're putting in the ground, you could be talking about a $65,000 savings to the city for this project you have now. And if you allow that going forward, you know, it could be more savings as long as the price of oil is what it is. Ferndale has C900 in the ground right now in several places around the community. Having worked in the city of Seattle and worked under their specifications, I can assure you that if there was anything wrong with this product, it would not be allowed in that town. So, I mean, Linden uses it, I think CMAS, Arlington. I mean, I've laid tons of it myself. So, all the fittings are completely interchangeable. Personally, I think it's an awesome product. I've laid miles of ductile iron pipeline where they made us put it in a plastic sleeve. So what's the point of, you know, doing that when you might just put plastic pipe in the ground to start with? So, and I sent you some email connections on, you know, the deal where what you can check it out for yourself as far as the quality of the product and so on and so forth. So I'd just like to urge that because it's not only good for the city, you can save a lot of money, but it's also good for developers in terms of them being able to save money on their projects. So I just think it's a good product. I think it should be given serious consideration. It could be done with an addendum. I know that job is out to bid right now, but, you know, you could add it as an addendum, as an alternate, you know, in terms of you know, price one, ductile iron, price two, C900 type thing, and then evaluate it from that point. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Collins. Saving money is music to our ears. Public Works Director Evans, could you check into that and maybe report back to Public Works Committee upcoming? And would you make sure I get the same email? I don't think I got it, Cleo. Please? I will check again. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Anyone else like to speak to council this evening? Seeing none, City Council, we have the consent agenda in front of you. What is your pleasure?
I make the motion that we approve.
Second. Been moved and seconded that we adopt the consent agenda. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. Thank you very much. Going on to item C, Transpo presentation, Main Street traffic light operation. I'm going to guess this is Public Works. Thank you, Kevin.
Good evening, Council. Kevin Renz, Public Works Director. I believe that last time we discussed this was in the context of coming forward with our right-of-way acquisition contract with the roundabout, and Council had requested that we look at the signals along the Main Street corridor and prioritize that going forward as a method for addressing traffic along the Main Street congestion. Excuse me. I had requested that Transpo go out and do an analysis of the currently installed signalization hardware that's located along the Main Street corridor, starting at the I-5 interchange and going over to the last light on Main Street. They went through and did an analysis of not only the controllers that are installed, but the detection hardware and the current inventory of everything there, and then further looked at its capacities and limitations, and then came up with a list of recommendations. Tonight we've got Daniel Lai from Transpo Group here to go through that report, and then following that, I'd like to discuss some recommendations going forward and then answer any questions that you have.
Welcome back.
Good evening, council members. Daniel Lai from Transpo Group, senior systems engineer. So about three, four weeks ago, our staff went out to the field, had a look at numerous traffic signal cabinets, as Kevin mentioned, within kind of all the way stretching from LaBounty all the way to Douglas, primarily looking at many of the system limitations and also what are some of the capabilities and features that are perhaps lacking so that we can optimize traffic operations along the corridor. And I think when we talk about optimizing corridor operations, we're talking about a couple things here. One is we've noticed or heard in the past that progression can sometimes be an issue through the downtown corridors. So specifically, some of these things that we looked at in the field, assessing hardware capabilities, primarily looks at how can we improve upon that. So as we conducted our traffic signal inventory, much of the equipment that we saw in the field about, in general terms, about two generations behind in terms of comparing to current signal controller technology. What that means is a lot of the current capabilities which allows signal controllers to talk to each other, if you will, communicate with each other, also proactively respond to detector loops in the ground that service demand more proactively are currently not quite there. And I think most of that is evident in the downtown corridors from 1st Ave to 4th Ave. And a lot of those traffic signal cabinets, you may have walked by them before, much smaller in form factor. Also, once you open up the cabinet, limited room for expansion in terms of being able to accommodate the detectors in the field. So what detector providing some investments in detectors would first of all allow the system to respond to the demand. And a lot of cities and also a lot of agencies that operate signals operate cabinets that are capable of more than or eight phases of vehicle movements within the downtown core or downtown intersections. Just for a frame of reference, all the signals are operating on two phases right now. So definitely more flexibility if we're able to provide additional features so that we can respond to the demand a little bit better. So kind of the recommendations that we presented are all incremental in nature. So we had a list that you may have all seen already. It looks like the table with kind of all the measurements of benefits versus the cost. Costs obviously range quite a bit from some of the line items starting at $10,000 and some of it escalates all the way to $400,000 depending on the nature of the improvement. So on the low, we'll call them lower hanging fruits here in terms of investments, we're talking about detector upgrades first of all, and also providing additional inputs in the cabinet that would provide that functionality for detection that I speak about. On the higher end of it, closer to the $400,000 range, we're talking about adaptive signal control, so systems that are able to utilize real-time detector loops to respond to the demand on the fly. The way that we structured the next steps on this report incrementally present the benefits such that every increment of new hardware that's placed in the field can be utilized for future improvements as well. So there's no throwaway in terms of how it's structured, and there's this forward compatibility that services the traffic signal hardware need that we've identified.
Councilmember Watson.
I'm just curious, we have the IDs 1, 2, 3, and then there's A, B, and A, B, and C. Are you saying that we should pick 2, and then we could pick A or B, and then if we went to 3, we could pick A, B, or C, or do the Bs need to be together and the Cs need to be together?
And, go ahead. They don't need to be together. The IDs identify the limitation or the issue that we observed, so if we take ID 2 as an example here, it says where communication interconnect exists, signal coordination between intersections is limited to time-based signal strategies only. So in order to address this limitation, there's option A or B, and certainly they don't need to, it's not a, if you choose A, you have to implement all of the A strategies. It doesn't work. You can kind of mix and match. Toward.
Yeah, and I guess to get to your question, was one of the things I was going to bring up during the discussion here, is that there are implementations like we can add the loop detection. That's a first step in the progress. And then following that, expanding that with item 2A to include the new controllers. And then to further expand that capability, you can implement item 2B on top of that. So it kind of goes in order where you're adding layers upon each one. So you cannot implement item B without implementing item A. And I apologize that it gets a little bit confusing, and that's I was going to detail everything in the staff report, and then it got even more confusing than having a discussion about it. So the when you go through and I'd like the council to look at it in a couple of like three tiers of operation, is that if we were to go in as a first tier and do some low-cost, low-hanging fruit upgrades, like Daniel was talking about, going in and doing the tearing out the separating the loops out so that we have the turning movements separated from the straight line movements within the downtown core. Currently, if you're transiting east-west on Main Street and you're in a left turn lane or a straight lane and you're stopped at a light, the signal has no idea that you're either wanting to turn or wanting to go straight. So it treats both of those movements identically. So if we separate those two out, then the controller can say, oh, we need to prioritize the left turn movement or we need to prioritize the straight line movement. And so we can get increased capacity through the system by separating those two out. So first step, do that. Implement a timing plan that incorporates that into it, and then optimize that through the core. So we have that as a first step. We'll need to do some cabinet upgrades at the same time to include the capacity to hold those detector cards within the cabinet. So that's the first step, and that's about a $50,000 improvement, I think, is the number that we've identified between the modeling of the traffic, the implementation of the detectors, and then the cabinet upgrades that are required for that. And then the next step would be going to better controllers and better interconnection between the signals that lie east of the river. Those are not currently connected together, nor are they connected with the ones on the west side. So if we can take that as a second step, and then further you could implement kind of the full meal deal going to the advanced signal technologies.
Councilmember Bursch and Councilmember Goodrich.
So the traffic lights on 1st, 2nd, 3rd Avenue are not part of the study?
They are.
Okay.
We conducted that assessment, and we've itemized on table one the cabinet types and signal controller types, which is consistent throughout the downtown, first to fourth. They're all consistent model types and controller types.
And they're from the same box?
They're separate. Each intersection has its own controller cabinet and traffic signal controller, local controller, we call it as well.
I have two questions. First one is on 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th streets. If you're coming to Main Street from either direction and you make a right, is the controller seeing that as a car coming up and wanting to go straight now? And would the change in loop, or is that something else that we'd have to do to where it knows that, hey, this car has turned right and there's nobody there anymore?
For right turn movements, it won't differentiate that with the improvements unless there's a dedicated right turn lane, because a lot of times the right turn and the through lane are shared lanes, so they share the same loop.
So once you drive across the loop, it doesn't know what you're doing, it's just that you've passed it, even with the upgrades?
For right turn movements, that's true. But for left turns, it'll be able to distinguish.
And then my other question is, how much of this do we need to do to where we get to the point where Bellingham is no longer involved in our signals and we're doing it ourselves?
None of the upgrades that are included in this get rid of Bellingham maintaining the signals. So right now Bellingham comes out and, you know, if we have a light outage, they replace the light. If there's something wrong in the cabinet, they take care of the cabinet. We do not currently have the in-house capability to do that. We don't have the personnel that are trained to manage the signaling hardware. We don't have the equipment to access the lights in the system. None of the upgrades here are intended at getting rid of the service that Bellingham provides, just at improving the operation of our signaling system.
Okay. So if we have an issue, what is Bellingham's turnaround time for coming out and fixing it? Like if we have a power glitch and it throws the signals out of whack, especially the first street signal, how long is it until they come out and
We've had excellent response time with the city of Bellingham. I couldn't give you specific. They're, you know, required to be here within 15 minutes. But we have an excellent working relationship with the city of Bellingham, and I feel in no way that they are any type of an impediment to the operation of the signals within the city. I think that they're a benefit and provide a good service for us.
Anyone on this side? Councilmember Olson?
Well.
And then Councilmember Watson, and then Councilmember Taylor.
I don't know if we can answer this, but is Bellingham familiar with what we are potentially looking at? Or are we going to have to send them to school to be trained in it?
I don't know that all of the hardware that is, I don't know the particulars of all the hardware that is in Bellingham, but anything that we went forward with would need to be compatible with the system that Bellingham operates in and would be able to be maintained by them unless we
would coordinate that.
Correct.
And a lot of the lower hanging fruit solutions we're talking about in the between first to fourth, LaBounty and also Douglas are already operating 8-phase signals at many of those intersections. So providing that functionality in the downtown area is something that's consistent with what's deployed on the outer edge signals.
I know you weren't asked to look at the timing of the signal to know whether they're 30 seconds or 45 seconds, but can you tell us, do we need 4 signals? I mean, is there one street that we could skip and still have traffic flow, or is that not something?
That is more of an operation-related question. We'd have to look at the model a little bit, or the traffic model in a little bit more detail to conduct that level of analysis, but it's all based on volume, so there's another level of assessment.
I would just be curious if we didn't have a light at first, if people would, could you get traffic backed up onto the bridge, if that would make any difference, or if your modeling shows that wouldn't make a difference?
We'd have to look at our model. There is an existing model that's calibrated for the PM peak period that would give us an indication of whether, you know, just the snapshot overview of what the PM operations would look like.
Because I mean, it's a very short downtown, and we have a light every single intersection. Yeah. So I'm wondering, do we need a light at every single intersection? Yeah. From a flow standpoint.
First one backs up the second.
Yeah.
You know, and then you can't get across second.
I don't know what it would cost to run that model, just try and determine. If you were specifically asking that one question, how many lights do we need and where should they be?
And I think right now, you know, we're at the position where, you know, we have the lights. We were specifically looking at the signaling system that was installed and trying to, you know, get better efficiency out of that system and then also look at the upgrades to that. I didn't request that Transpo, you know, look at different scenarios on elimination of lights or anything of that nature. So, you know, that could be something that we would move to as, you know, a further step on down the line to evaluate whether all 4 lights through the downtown corridor are necessary or, you know, provide benefit. And, you know, as a further step, we could evaluate that. But for the scope of this report, that wasn't looked at. One of the things that Transpo did do was they ran with, they did put the current signaling plan timing methodology into the model and looked at it, and do believe that we can have some efficiencies like I detailed in the staff report, is detailed in Daniel's report, is that just through simple modifications to the system and timing plans that we can see about a 10% reduction in delay through the downtown corridor. And that was the question that I had asked Daniel and the transportation engineers at Transpo was, you know, what does 10% look like? Is that a, you know, is that I sit in traffic every day and that feels good to me? I was like, wow, that was a real, you know, benefit. Or was it, you know, we didn't get that. And I think Daniel can elaborate a little bit on what they were.
So the 10% benefit that we have assessed for the PM peak period really translates to about what we call vehicle hour delay. So if we take the peak period in the day and we add up the total amount of delay experienced by every single vehicle traversing that corridor, primarily in that downtown section, we add it up for that peak 1-hour period. That, if we add all that up in the condition where we do nothing, in the condition where we make improvements, all that cumulative 10% reduction relates to that cumulative amount of delay for all the vehicles. Now, how that translates to what a driver would experience on the corridor is primarily related to what we call the green band. So, and the green band is how much green time is provided for a vehicle to traverse the intersection without being interrupted by a red light. So the larger the green band, typically the more vehicles can go through. So in the condition where we do nothing, there are some cases where we saw that the green band is about 29 seconds, and then the improved condition shows the green band widened out to about 40 seconds. So that's an additional 11 seconds that a vehicle can visually see as they're driving down the corridor as additional time that they can traverse through all the intersections without hitting a red light. And 11%, when we're comparing it to 29 seconds, is about a 30% increase in a little bit more than that, 30% or 35%, somewhere around there, of visible green time, which is quite a bit. I think the general public driving down the corridor would notice that.
Okay. Council, I try to remember the microphone so the folks in the back can hear. Council Member Taylor, okay? Council Member Bursch.
I know I've heard this figure before, but I have forgotten. What do we pay Bellingham annually for their services?
I don't have the annual figure in front of me. It's on a per-hour basis, so it varies based on what happens with the, you know, it would be more if somebody ran over a signal cab, but it would be less if we just had a bulb burnout. So, you know, it's completely dependent on what the situations are, but it's just on a time and materials basis.
Okay.
Councilmember Goodrich.
That's a question we probably include our esteemed treasurer, but do we have any money that we can put toward these projects? Are you looking at about, what, $60,000, $70,000 to do the low-hanging fruit? Do we have any funds or anything available for that, or we just got a study here that we're going to have to wait some time to implement?
City Treasurer Peterson, you've been addressed.
Thank you for that question. One source of funds are our masked traffic impact fees. We have $400,000 in the traffic impact fee fund that's used for improvements to traffic, and this certainly is a planned improvement to the flow. You could use some of that $400,000 now. We collect that money as we go throughout the year, and we're going to talk about tip fees later on tonight. But we're under our estimate in terms of revenue collection this year so far through April, but there is $400,000 right now, cash, in the TIF fund.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Other questions from Ferndale Council?
I guess just going back to the memo and the discussion, the staff report that went with it, I think what would be valuable, for myself would be just like an appraisal of what type of, you know, is the council supportive of going for a large expenditure, mid-range expenditure, small expenditure, putting together a project to improve the signaling plan. As I indicated in the staff report and Marcus said, there is some funding available for it, but it wasn't included as a 2016 budget item, nor was it included on our capital program for this year. Putting a project together, if we were to go with a, you know, the larger scope replacement of cabinets, replacement of hardware, I would envision that being a project that would be included in our six-year capital improvement plan and then integrated into the budget over the either the 2017 or further budgetary years. So we could implement some changes in the short term that would be lower cost, short term kind of stopgap measures as we approach the concept of spending that $600,000. But one thing that, you know, I think needs to be said is that if we spend $500,000 plus on signals, we're addressing the electronic portion of it, but we're not addressing the larger issue that we're constrained at several choke points along the Main Street corridor. So when you look at the Burlington Northern Crossing and you look at the bridge, we can spend $500,000 on signal and get an incremental improvement in transit time through the downtown core, but we're still constrained by the physical attributes of the corridor itself. With the projects such as Thornton that are coming up, I think that it's, you know, a big decision to spend $500,000 on traffic lights that we could put towards the Thornton overcrossing with the lack in funding that we have there. So is it a better decision to do a smaller expenditure that gives us some benefit and reduces the delay within the corridor while saving that larger expenditure? So,
City Administrator.
Maybe this might help. I was looking into the transpo report at our next steps. Say prior to investing in hardware, they recommend the city conduct a study to evaluate the effectiveness of the existing signal timing plans. How much would that cost and how long would that take if that is indeed perhaps a first incremental step?
Yeah. So that is the lowest hanging fruit because it doesn't require any new hardware to be purchased or installed in the field. So implementing that is about it ranges between $10,000 to $25,000 depending on the level of effort, because there's different types of modeling effort or modeling tools available. Some require a higher level of effort than others. Also to note, we only have PM data and not other periods.
And that was one of the things with the data. We did, Transpo did some analysis on the timing plans, as I indicated before. They just did that with the PM peak hour, so just looking at one snapshot in time and then trying to look at the impacts of that. In order to get a comprehensive timing plan for the signals on Main Street, we need to look at more than just the PM peak. We need to look at the AM and midday time as well, and then come up with a timing and coordination plan for those signals that would encompass the entire day rather than just one snapshot in time in the evening hours.
Councilmember Olson and Councilmember Goodrich, please.
I hate to keep saying this, but prior to you getting here, actually a good thing, is when we were discussing the Labounty roundabout, we were all, to my recollection, pretty well adamant that before we make a roundabout, to just back up into that, we were going to fix that downtown so that they actually could channel through there rather than have a whole roundabout filled with cars and nobody can enter it. So I don't know if you're aware of that, but that's kind of where we're at, and that's why we're pushing this, because before that roundabout happens, granted we have a new council, things change, I don't think the roundabout would fly unless we get this problem straightened out here. So whatever we have to do, I mean, I'm willing to support studying it further if we have to do so that we can know exactly what we need to buy and not waste bad money or good money after bad.
Yeah, I think that as was indicated in the report, is that the first steps in that are going in and doing the assessment of the timing plan and coming up with a better timing plan methodology, and then utilizing the information we gain from that to further design improvements to the corridor. Because I think that, the information that's gained through that study of the timing analysis would lead to a more refined approach for signalization improvements and hardware improvements.
And I would agree with that, because I've been on the east side down by City Hall trying to go eastbound at 10 o'clock and be bumper to bumper, and it's because of those signals again. So, yeah, you're right. It has to be multiple times.
Councilmember Goodrich and then Councilmember Birch.
Two things. One is I'd like to see this taken back now to the Public Works Committee, and then we can discuss it there about some ideas as far as what we'd like to see for the modeling and things before you guys go out and do a whole bunch of stuff. But like Councilmember Watson said, well, what if you eliminated First Street signal or something? So I'd like to see this go back there. The other thing is, too, if we're going to do data, I don't know if Bo has all day data from our counts, but if we're looking at getting any new data, we're going to have to most likely wait until after school starts again, because you only got a couple of weeks where you're going to have this, all the school traffic and the buses and things, and traffic changes in the summertime and stuff. So to say, okay, we're going to go out in June or July and do traffic counts for the model, you're not going to get the worst case scenario that you get during the school year. So that's something to also
And I don't know if Transpo has further data besides the PM peak. I know that the PM peak was what was analyzed. So
yeah, we only have PM peak hour data, so that conducting that level of analysis would require additional data collection, and I agree with that statement that we'd want to confine it to within the school period for sure.
So I think some of this we just need to talk at committee.
Mm-hmm. Councilmember
Birch. I was just going to reaffirm what Councilmember Olson said. Before we go buy that box of Band-Aids and they are easily removed, we need to send it back to committee. So mm-hmm. I agree with that too. Band-Aids aren't the fix.
And Council, is there any more information you may need from Transpo before that meeting? You think you got it all? Or Councilmember Watson.
I guess I would like to know when your PM peak data is from, what year it was from.
I'd have to check because I didn't do the operations modeling at Transpo Group, so we should have that data available.
Like, 2015. What time frame do you? What months? Was it?
About this time of year.
Okay.
Council, any more questions of this guest? Thank you for coming up. We do have an audience question. I'm fine with that. Mr. Collin, come up. Talk about signalization here.
Just a thought that you guys might want to consider, since this is maybe just a short-term solution and really the overpass is the long-term solution. Having been involved in an immense amount of engineering FUPAs, and I know that these guys are well qualified at what they do, perhaps one other solution might be to spend money on having Bellingham come out here and just play with that signal system and figure out on the ground what actually works the best, rather than pay an engineering firm a whole ton of money and spend a whole lot of time doing a whole lot of studies and maybe not get it right. I'm sure they probably will, but I have been on the receiving end of, I can't tell you how many change orders due to engineering FUPAs. So it's just another way that you might be able to do it and save some money. Thank you.
Thank you, Cleo. I believe so.
We have done that, but the problem now is they don't necessarily communicate with one another. If there's a power outage, everything changes, and sometimes it just gets, someone pushes the pedestrian switch, and then it all completely changes. So they get the timing, and it's good for an hour or so until.
Thank you, Council. Thank you, Daniel, for being with us. And we now go on to Transportation 301. Again, there will be a quiz. Mr. Burnett, welcome back.
Take notes.
This is for you. Our clerk has provided us so you can write your questions down. So we found it much more efficient, and staff likes it. If they can get through their presentation and then save your questions for them, they might just answer those questions before we get there. Mr. Burnett, we're glad to have you.
Good evening, Council. Good evening, Mr. Mayor. Sorry for the audience that I'm kind of standing right in the middle of where you might want to be looking, but won't be for too much longer because we're getting new technology. I don't know if there's another room for it. So, Transportation 301, this is our third meeting talking about transportation issues. The first was very general. The next focused much more on the projects. And here we're saying this is really where the rubber meets the road because we're starting to talk about traffic impact fees. So Director Rents and the City Administrator will probably chime in, as potentially so will our Finance Director as we go through here. I'm guessing that this is probably going to be about a 20-minute presentation, and I'll get going. So first, what we want to do is we want to do a little bit of clarification on the projects that we discussed, compare that to our existing comprehensive plan and the projects listed there, talk about the implications of the impact fee discussion, what our existing policies are, and most likely what direction we might be recommending the council go in about a month or two. So starting off, what has changed since 2011 and why has it changed? This is not intended to be an exhaustive summary of all of the different projects. It's supposed to give you a really quick survey of the kind of trend lines that we're seeing in some of them. So the Portal Way and Enterprise intersection improvement, where it replaces a Trigg Road roundabout. So here is the improvement that's currently proposed, and here was the roundabout that used to be there. And I'm not sure if Kevin wants to talk a little bit about why they might have changed.
Yeah. Well.
Better idea?
Yeah. Now, it used to be that the Thornton Road interchange was seen as going over I-5, and that would lead for greater traffic volumes going to the Trigger Portal Way interchange, which would have necessitated the roundabout at that intersection. With that project being removed from the, kind of immediate list of projects, the kind of need moves further north so that we can address some potential safety impacts at the Portal Way you know, Enterprise intersection and not the capacity improvements at the roundabout.
So, money savings. Next, Newkirk roundabout. Really the same issue, I think.
Yeah. And this is, you know, more of that. With the Thornton Crossing going over to Portal Way, it's seen that, you know, more traffic would be going on to that. So it's just another capacity-related project that is not required with the modeling that goes out to 2036. So.
And you're going to see a trend, or if you don't see it, you should look for a trend, where since we are talking about our projects being part of the overall transportation system, when one thing happens or doesn't happen or changes or doesn't change, you're going to see the domino effects of that. So we've so far been talking about ramifications of Thornton, and here's another one where this is actually an increase, perhaps.
Yeah. So the increase here for right-of-way acquisition costs is that the roundabout that's going to be located with this, with the traffic volume projections that are going down Thornton and Molloy, funneling traffic towards that Thornton overchange, the roundabout located at Thornton and Molloy needs to be upsized. So there's further right-of-way implications at that intersection.
Next, there's a fun PowerPoint. There we go. Here's another decrease where instead of putting a roundabout in at Nordic and LeBounty, we are putting in
a signal. Yeah. So same thing, changes in.
So $500,000 change. All of a sudden, we can afford the signals.
Do you have a time frame for that?
I'm sorry?
Time frame?
Consistent with the development going into that area. The intersection improvements that are at Nordic and LeBounty are a part of the project. It's wrapped in with the Main and LeBounty roundabout. So those are all going on at the same time, the improvements to that intersection. We're doing a stormwater and a sewer project. You can see the green line that's on there is, you know, another project that's indicated. This is a screenshot from the PowerPoint, but the GIS program that overlays the project. So you can see that we have another project going on concurrently with that one. So going to be doing stormwater improvements through that corridor, sewer improvements, and then the intersection and roundabout are all tied together into one project.
And again, when we're talking about what's the timing of this, a lot of it is driven by development. This is one that is. Although, depending on how long you look into the future, at some point this project or a form of it is going to be necessary. Mm-hmm. Similar to how we were talking about, well, Newkirk isn't going to be required, we don't think, within this 20-year period. More than likely, maybe it's 25, maybe it's 50 years out, there will need to be an improvement at Newkirk. So the projects come on or come off not because they're no longer good ideas, but possibly because growth is a little bit less than what we were expecting just 4 years ago, or because the way that we configure it is different.
We could have, you know, and it's also entirely possible that we change zoning in the intervening time where, you know, the assumptions for growth in those areas are different than they were when the last plan was put together. So when we look back to the, you know, 2011 and moving forward 5 years into the future, the assumptions that we're going into it with are a little bit different than they were in the previous iteration of the plan.
Now, so far we've really focused on more decreases in expenses, and you'll see a number of those where I think that our overall list is a little bit less than what we had seen a few years ago, but there are some increases, and generally they're fairly significant, and Portal Way is one of them. And you've heard over and over about how Portal Way is deficient. You've probably seen it as well. Well, in order to fix it, we're talking about a project that's about 40% longer than Main Street Phase 3, which was Douglas to Church, a cost, planning level cost, of about $4.5 million. It is partially traffic impact fee eligible, but it does not significantly expand the capacity, where maybe a center turn lane, but other than that, you still have two lanes of traffic coming through.
But a significant increase in pedestrian safety and also an improvement to the corridor out there.
Did you say 4.5 or says
14.3? And so the follow-up question might be, or statement might be, gosh, that's more than it should cost. These are planning level costs, as we've discussed before, where on average to do 1.2 miles of road in Whatcom County, this is about what you're likely to see. There might be some variation in terms of the right-of-way acquisition cost or the actual design of it, but this is a reasonable assumption for projects within Whatcom County. Mm-hmm.
So the project costs that are included in the 20-year project list and the project costs that we're talking about right now, we're all developed using a consistent methodology where we have a spreadsheet that's developed that takes into consideration material cost, roadway section cost, the scope of the improvements, the length of improvements, size type, that are going forward, and then uses that and applies them as a consistent methodology from one project to the next. So we believe that the costs, the design costs that are included in here are legitimate costs, and not only legitimate, but they're also comparable to each other. They're all put together using the same set of assumptions.
Hang on to those questions. Good job.
All right. So moving from planning level to more design costs, we anticipated that in 2011 that it had cost almost $40 million to do not only the Thornton connection to 2nd, but go all the way over to Porter Way. So almost $40 million, a significant portion of that was a project that we know now is 20 years or longer into the future. The 2016 plan projects it at a planning level cost of about $22.4 million, but as you've seen from Shearer, there are new things that we now know.
Yeah. And so, as with any project, we can develop, going forward with the comp plan, we develop a planning level cost that is taking into account certain assumptions that are road size type, material cost, those kind of general assumptions that we use. And then when we get down to doing a project and looking at it, as we know with the Thornton Crossing, getting into a little bit more of the design phase of it and looking at it, it's like, oh, now we know that we have deficient soils that need to be mitigated for. We know that we have other aspects of the project that need to be mitigated for. So as you get down to that more specific cost, the costs are better identified and are, more what you're going to see when you get your bid. So as we get closer and closer to the today in the planning period, the costs are identified more precisely within that document.
So here we have two back-to-back projects where we had Portal, where you might be able to argue, gosh, that's estimating higher than we'd expect to be. And then you have Thornton, where the planning level estimates are a little bit lower. It's not an exact science at the planning level costs, but they do tend to equal out. So when we are talking about the final costs, we think that we're within a reasonable ballpark. And what we're seeing, comparing the 2011 to the 2016, it's an increase of about $12 million. And when you really think about it, we're talking big money here, but when you really think about it, the five-year cost, when you factor in inflation, going up $12 million, it's probably about what you'd expect.
And especially with construction costs, seems to be rising at a faster pace than what general inflation is. So, I think that the costs that are identified within this plan are quite legitimate within the scope of what was identified in the last comp plan.
So, and these are important numbers to remember because we're going to get back to them. This does include maintenance of operations. It does not include other agency improvements that might be going on. But these are the checks around these numbers that we're expecting to have to write over the next 20 years. And so the question is going to be, how are we going to fund those? Which moves us into our next section, which is impact fees. So from 1997 to 2011, I'm not going to go into a whole bunch of detail because we gave you the generals back last time. We were location-based, and what that means is we had a fairly complicated, very difficult to understand system where we would say, okay, we have a project here, and it's about halfway between 125 and 127. And what we would do is we would then plug that into this spreadsheet where distance from point A, distance from point B, and we'd plug in the type of use, and it would spit out a number to us. It might be that our current planner would measure it a little bit differently from where I would. It might be that Kevin would measure it a little bit differently as well. But They would come out with a number, and that would be ultimately what they paid. We like to think, or we've created this narrative that prior to 2011, we didn't charge much in terms of impact fees. And while that's generally true, it wasn't true throughout the city. Because of this vehicle miles travel distance, we tended to see that folks that were close to the interstate paid very little, and then folks up in the northwest portion who had to drive more Ferndale roads ended up paying a lot more. To the tune of when you were up at Pacific Highlands, you were paying about $4,000 a house as far back as 1997. Remember, our current fees are right around $2,300 a house. So you're almost paying double that all the way back in 1997. Whereas if you were down at Slater, you were paying as low as about $100 a trip. That's $100 a trip, 1/23rd of what we pay now, 4% of what we pay now. They were paying as recently as 2011. Needless to say, that's why we say that the fees were generally less. And in fact, the folks up on top of the hill were paying most of those fees, and the folks down at the bottom were not. 2011, we moved to citywide fees, and we had a theoretical, and we've talked about this a little bit more. Theoretically, we could probably have charged $5,000 per trip. That if you based it on the maximum of the development-related costs, almost double what we ended up doing. We ended up at $2,300. One of the main reasons why we ended up at $2,300 is because council said, bring us a fee that's about $1,000 less than what you were recommending, which was about $3,500. So we're not pretending that we arrived at $2,300 scientifically. We arrived at it because it was $1,000 less than what the recommendation was. And no one has challenged it. While I think that council is saying that they want to be a little bit more scientific this time, and we would encourage that, you end up with what you feel comfortable with. And that's one of the reasons why we're taking this approach now, is to see what is your comfort level coming up from the bottom rather than starting at $3,500 and ending up $1,000 less. Regardless, approximately $2,300 meant that development would pay for about 24% of the total capital costs. So the city's adopted policy or in place policy would be that development pays 24% of the costs. And what you can't see right now is that my computer is trying to sabotage, but I think that I fixed it. Impact fees background. After that, in 2012, we did the planned action. The theoretical then was about $4,200. It was a little bit less because it was than what the theoretical was before, because we had more trips to spread it out with. We ended up adopting a variety of different fees ranging from $2,300 in the downtown area per PM trip to about $3,200 in the planned action area. Where did that get us? So as you can see up here, or possibly can't, Ferndale is around here. We're about midway amongst all of the Western Washington cities in terms of impact fees. For those of you who were here 4 or 5 years ago when we first adopted our fees, we were up here. We are now below the average for Washington traffic impact fees at whatever that is, about $2,600 on average. On up to these folks are closer to...
Yeah, so up at the top of the chart there, we've got Redmond that's at $8,462 and Kenmore... That's $8,350 for the top two that are indicated on the graph there. Now, one thing that's interesting to note with this is that the city of Sammamish is not included on this chart and was not included in calculating the Washington State average because their fee is $14,064 per residential unit. Okay. So a little bit of an outlier for the rest of the state.
Shoot the moon policy.
Well, and so what you end up, we're providing this because it's of interest. What we've always recommended to council is to do what's best for Ferndale and what makes most sense for Ferndale in order to pay for the cost of development projects. These are interesting to see whether or not we are well outside of the norm, but ultimately you need to come up with the most responsible decision for Ferndale. So, our overall funding strategy adopted in the comprehensive plan says that 15% of our transportation projects will be paid for on average through REIT 2 solid waste, water, sewer, and transportation benefit district. We also say that we would expect that traffic impact fees and other developer commitments would be 55% of the costs, and then grant funding would be about 30%. Now, in the last 5 years, we haven't done too many growth-related projects. The transportation projects we've done have been, you know, going back to what we talked about last time, meeting our development standards, addressing safety issues, a lot of pavement overlays. So those aren't necessarily projects that you would expect we'd spend a lot of traffic impact fees on. But over the last 5 years, we find that we are funding 15% through the city funds, general city funds, only about 15% through traffic impact fees. Remember, we expect it to be closer to 55% on average. 5% through the transportation benefit district, and 65% through grant funding. Your public works staff has been tremendously successful at obtaining those grant funds, which have helped us to do the projects that we have done over the last 5 years. But will it continue? Because the projects that we've done, Main from Douglas to Church, Thornton Street Preservation, Vista Preservation, Lego Washington, a whole bunch of others, again, we've been really active. But do we expect that to continue? Again, we've been extraordinarily successful. Do we expect to be able to get $94 million in additional grant funding over the next 20 years? Because that's what we would be looking at if we kept with our current trajectory. Or how are we going to close that gap? We expect that a lot of the projects that we have in the future are going to be growth related, so we will have to use traffic impact fees or have to hope that we can get grants or come up with it through other city sources. We do expect that we're going to continue to have higher development costs. If you looked at the construction cost index for transportation projects over the last couple of years, it's skyrocketing, and partly because when Seattle grows, the costs go up. Thank goodness the petroleum costs have gone down because it's kind of moderated a bit. But once we find the equilibrium, if we're not there, they're probably going to keep on going. We don't know that for sure, and we will benefit from the lower costs when we can. We're also expecting slightly lower overall growth, which means that we'll have slightly fewer trips to distribute that amongst. That ends up being more or less in the noise of the calculations. But overall, our conclusion is that we're going to be coming back to you over the next couple months with a moderate increase in impact fees from what we have now. So, there we go. Questions? That's the end of transportation.
Councilmember Birch is first, and Councilmember Olson. Thank you.
Yeah, that chart that started with Redmond. Mm-hmm. That one. Oh. How many cities in Whatcom County are above Ferndale, pay more than Ferndale?
I don't believe any are. Part of that is because none of them have updated their impact fees since before the Great Recession. We would expect that they will all update their comprehensive plans within the next month and a half. What they choose to do as far as the policy is anyone's guess.
This chart was put together by the City of Bellingham. So if you look at the color coding on the chart, you can see that there's the top yellow line is the right there is the Washington State average. The next line down is the colored line is Ferndale. And then we have going down from that, we have the median 50% TIF is the yellow line, and then Linden down and then the green lines are the City of Bellingham. They've implemented methodology by which they're doing some incentives for people putting in development within what they consider to be urban villages. So they've offered some price incentives for development within those urban villages, and then down at the bottom is Blaine. So that kind of just outlines where we're at with them.
And it is also important to remember what the other cities measure as far as the level of service compared to ours, where Bellingham, as we know, has adopted a multimodal level of service where they allow bicyclists and pedestrians and transit development to demonstrate how they have addressed those as a possible mitigating factor. For automobiles, they have also adopted level of service D, I believe, and sometimes F.
Sometimes F.
Yeah.
Councilmember Olson, please.
I think you didn't mention, correct me if I'm wrong, but for the newer council members, you did not come up with these figures. We paid a hefty fee to Transpo to study this and give us their recommendation, which the majority of the past council, not all of them, tossed out and gave you that explanation that you gave us all. So I just wanted to point out that it wasn't you guys coming up with your own figures out of thin air. It was studied and recommended.
That is correct.
Okay.
Other questions to staff? Councilmember Watson and Councilmember Hanson.
So when you come to us with your TIF recommendations, is it going to be based on developers paying 50% or 60% or 65%? Is that how you're going to bring it to us?
Our understanding from council is that you would rather start off with a percentage than a dollar figure, so that you could say, we feel comfortable with this percentage, now tell us what that means in terms of dollars, rather than saying $3,000 and that equals 10% or that equals 80%.
And I'd like you to pick the percentage. So tell us what you need, and then we'll go from there. It would help me.
Okay. And we talked to Transpo this afternoon about the precise way of bringing it forward, so that helps. Thank you.
One comment from the mayor is I remember when we did vote on these fees, by the way, I preferred the higher fees, was that sense that we were in a recession at the time and building had slowed down a little bit. So different times today. Councilmember Hanser.
So I just want to make sure that I understood you correctly. And you said that we expect development to contribute about 55% of the cost to deal with traffic issues, correct?
And that's what our adopted plan says.
That's the adopted plan, yet currently it only pays for about 24%.
Yes, but I don't want to gin the numbers up. Over the last 5 years, we do not have projects that we would have expected to cost a lot as far as traffic impact fees. But of those projects, yes, they did only.
More questions?
I'm sorry, because I was thinking of the wrong slide. Our adopted traffic impact fees would only result in 24% of the overall 20-year costs.
Okay. More questions of staff? Mr. Callum. Welcome back.
Darcy Jones with Jones Engineers sat down with Whatcom County Engineering over numerous meetings and compared numbers of what it costs to do a city arterial improvement project, which includes full city arterial standards, curb, gutter, sidewalk, street lights, enclosed drainage, the whole nine yards. And they came up with an agreed price of $1,000 a linear foot. That's less than half of what you're being shown here, which to me throws all the numbers completely out of whack. So I'm like completely set. $2,200 a foot to build a city street, and I build a lot of them. those numbers don't add up to me. The other thing that Kevin alluded to or mentioned that I'll send you guys an email, but I was at a meeting with the city of Bellingham, and their planning department is actively encouraging, and the city council chambers were full of developers, and they're doing every single thing they can to try to cut costs legally to the development community to try to bring business into Bellingham, and they're being successful. I mean, they got Costco right out from underneath Ferndale, just like that. Bellsperm Law was going to come to Ferndale at one point in time. They lost that. So I'll send you guys an email, but you can go on to the City of Bellingham's website under services and look at what the City of Bellingham is doing to try to encourage developers to come to the City of Bellingham. When I left that meeting, there was a little gal standing there saying, "Are you looking at developing property in Ferndale and Bellingham, Mr. Keller?" I said, "Well, I'm considering it." She says, "Please come." She says, "I will help you every way I can, and we will cut costs every way we can to get business in the City of Bellingham." So what I'm trying to stress here is this is a business. It's a partnership. When you encourage business, you bring business into Ferndale, that's where your money comes from. That's where your tax dollars come from. That's what makes so you have roads and streets and parks and et cetera, is from business. So if you look at it from that perspective and you encourage business to come here, they are looking at it as an investment. They're not getting any revenue off of that vacant lot now. If a businessman comes into town and he builds a business on that lot and he brings revenue to the City of Ferndale, that helps you do what you want to do in terms of bringing money. So that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cowell. Thank you, staff. Thank you, City Council. I believe we're going to move on to the next agenda item. Here we go. Item E, Contract Slater Interchain Master Plan. I believe that's Mr. Burnett today.
It is, and I think that City Administrator and Director Renz will also join in. We are requesting authorization to enter into a contract with Transpo Group where we would analyze in several steps and would have the ability to halt after each step if necessary to analyze work that has already been done associated with Exit 260, which is the Slater Interchange. There's been work, as you know, that's been performed by Parametrics and Gibson Traffic on behalf of the Lummi Nation. The City of Ferndale wishes to evaluate that analysis by utilizing the Transpo Group to determine whether or not it was not only done technically correctly, which we expect it was, but that it included all of the inputs necessary to properly evaluate not only development in one of the areas at the interchange, but within the basin that would logically serve the interchange. So the first step would be to analyze to see whether or not our consultants believe the original or existing analysis was completed correctly, if there are any questions remaining. If it turns out that our consultants say, "Gosh, you know, this is great, this is perfect, there's nothing missing," we could terminate the contract, and we would expect that we would then go back and continue to work with the Lummi Nation and the other participants, Port of Bellingham, City of Bellingham, Whatcom County, Washington State, to come up with that final improvement. If it turns out that there's additional inputs that need to be put in or some stress testing to determine where traffic is coming from or where it could come from and whether or not that would modify the conclusions, we would go into that next second step and start to do that stress testing and other things. We would expect that if we did have to go to the second step that we would bring in those other partners to evaluate what are the stresses that we should place on it. Do we look at northbound, southbound? Do we look at eastbound, westbound, all that sort of thing? We would expect that the first step would be completed, gosh, you know, by midsummer, I would think, at the latest. Transpo Group already has a lot of the information. They're just waiting to really start officially looking at it. Then we have not been led to believe that it would be a significant amount of additional time to complete the rest of it. Of course, it depends on what the conclusions are and step one and the inputs that we and our partners then want to put in there. But I would not think that it would be too much to expect that by the time we're getting into the holiday season, that at the latest, that it would be done. Right now, we're looking at approximately $15,000, I believe. And we would ask your permission to enter into the contract. Again, council has said that they want to be informed prior to us moving to step two, if in fact we do need to go to step two.
City Council, questions of Mr. Burnett? Councilmember Watson.
When you talk about full build-out, how are you going to determine what theoretical businesses will be in all those quadrants? And because we're not sure with the zoning changes, because we've asked for that one area to go UGA Reserve to pull into our UGA, so how will we determine that?
Right. Well, so that's going to be part of if we go into the step two of talking with the other folks. The easiest and most objective way of going about it is to assign a certain density or floor area ratio or whatever you want to call it per acre, and to have a couple of assumptions that if it's commercial, you're going to, for instance, have a 70-20-10 split where maybe 70% of a commercial property is retail, 20% is, I forget which is the difference between 20 and 10, 20% would be offices or service, and then 10% would be restaurants, and those two, again, might be switched. Okay. If it was industrial properties, there would be a kind of similar generic split, and then an assumption on just how much of a parcel is developable. We would be able to rely on part on the land capacity analysis that already went through, where those are objective, already existing measurements. But again, then do some stress testing, where it might be that, to use the possibly known example, that the Lummi Nations development might be more or less intense than that average. So what would happen if we did expand it out to the average or decrease it down to the average? What would happen if we assume airport traffic? Since we would have the model created through the transport group, and it is already in the basic model is set up, it does not take too much to change the assumptions in there.
So it wouldn't be until part two when you take into account the Costco flow, what's going to be happening when Costco was built, what that flow south on Bakerview, what that's going to impact on Slater. Is that going to be a part two study?
Well, part of it would be part one, because okay. My understanding is that the Gibson and Parametric study did look at the pipeline projects or certain of the pipeline projects and to evaluate, okay, is this realistic? It might be, and I have no idea, but it might be that coming out of it, to use that as an example, Costco may have been analyzed, but perhaps Transpo would say, gosh, we think that 30% of the trips could very well be coming up a different route that wasn't analyzed. Okay. And then we would come back to you and say, maybe we're only looking at that in council. Do you think that evaluating that 30% of this one project is worth it or not?
Okay. I think that staff, and I would include the mayor, feel like this is our due diligence, our responsibilities. I keep thinking of the $200,000 we spent on Main Street and I-5, not the same scope, but it's similar. We wanted some certainty for developers and certainty for us, so I think this is a great idea. More questions from the City Council? Councilmember Hanson.
Yori, the $15,000, does that include both Phase 1 and Phase 2, or is that just the first phase?
I believe that it does include both. Clearly, well, yeah. Transpo also would likely let us know, and we can make that a requirement, that if we get down beneath a certain level, that they would start letting us know so that they're not getting phone calls from all of staff saying, test this, test this, test this, so that we can make sure that we complete it.
Mr. Myrna, Mr. Callan asked earlier in the meeting the cost, and you provided that, but also the how long this might take, I believe, was his other question.
Right. So the cost right now is estimated to be $15,000. How long it would take, that first step would be, it's a peer review, really, at this point. So that would be probably measured in weeks rather than multiple months.
Thank you.
And then by the end of the year, I would expect.
More questions of council? Councilmember Watson.
I would move to approve Agenda Bill 05-008.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to spend some $15,000 on Transpo's study of the Slater interchange. Are there any questions from council? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. It's passed 7-0. Thank you, council, and thank you, Yori. Going on, here we go. Item F, capital projects infrastructure inspector position. That sounds vaguely familiar. I believe Mr. Rentz, we get you back on deck.
Thank you. Yeah, and I'm going to invite Katie Ratter, our project manager, to come up to the microphone so she can join us for this discussion. We previously had brought this to the Public Works Committee, then brought it forward to the full council, then took it back to the Finance Committee, and now we're back at the full council again to have a discussion. We had brought forward the item to add a Public Works Capital Inspector, a person that would go out and assist the city by inspecting capital projects that we undertake, whether that's a sewer project, water project, or road project, or a combination of all the above, to assist both during the design phase and during the construction phase, working with the project manager and providing benefit to the city by being a point of contact out in the field and the person that is available to assist with the vetting the plants and everything else. I don't know. I know that there had been some discussion from council that they were curious about what types of projects we would sit this person out with. I've taken a look through our upcoming capital projects. For the short term, we are dealing with a project that just went into design for, or has yet to go into design for Washington to from Vista to Maine. We have a project that we're going to be completing in the short term from 3rd Street from Maine to Alder. We're working with a reservoir modification to our number one reservoir up on Thornton. We're extending a sewer line down Thornton Road and connecting it with the roundabout at 2nd Street. We're also envisioning bringing that from a pump station that's with the Malloy Village project and bringing that down through the east side of the Samson Rope property to connect so that we can get rid of that station. We have our overlay project that we're going to be doing out on Portal Way from Grandview to Enterprise, and then also some, you know, sidewalk projects that we would have ongoing around the city. You know, these are just some examples of projects that we could send that an inspector out on, just examples of things that we have kind of queued up in the current pipeline. And I think Katie wants to add anything to that or a thought of, like, what type of activities we would be sending this person out into the field to engage in.
Like Kevin said, as far as inspection goes, this person would be available to do inspection for the projects. I know I wasn't here. I apologize that I wasn't able to sit in on the committee meetings, but I did listen to the audio. And so there were some really good questions. And one of those, I think Councilmember Goodrich brought up that, you know, if you have six projects going on, is this inspector going to be camped out at the one and not able to look at the other five? And generally the way we do the inspection itself, construction, it either happens like in a big fat hurry right now and it's kind of ugly and you have to be there and be paying attention, or you have this pace where it's like, okay, you know, they're prepping to do what they need to do. We can see how they're using their means and their methods and the way they're you know, moving forward with the construction. So a lot of times you can schedule more than one project to have somebody go and look at. It's possible, just depending on the type of the project and the duration and, you know, what's going on at the time, that an inspector can go and, you know, check out three different projects at, you know, in one day or whatever. I think there was a question too about, you know, just like the volume of, I'm kind of getting off topic here, but the volume of work, you know, compared to what kind of work the city's done in the past versus our workload in the future. I think maybe you would ask that. I'm not sure. But
no, go ahead, blame me.
I thought it was a good question because, you know,
oh, yeah,
honestly,
that was mine.
Councilmember Olson, right? So, so, you know, when we developed the CIP last year, and Greg was moving Public Works forward with that, it's pretty aggressive. And just to kind of put things in perspective, broad strokes here, in 2014, we did a sewer on Cottage Place. We installed street trees on Main Street, did the culvert at City Hall so the library parking lot could be done, Church Road, which kind of spanned into 2015, and then we did the Barrett Road resurfacing. That was about $4 million worth of work. Compared to the list of construction that we've got on tap for this year, and it's almost mid-May, it adds up to like $7.5 million of work. So there really is a lot of work that needs to be done, not only actively when construction's happening, but also up to the point that we're ready to put plans out to bid. A lot of the work, and I've mentioned this before, up front is, you know, you hire a designer and you tell them what their scope is, and they go out there and they start collecting survey data, and they start asking you a bunch of questions because they want to see your project succeed. They want to design something that's going to work. And so a lot of times, or most of the time, those questions get funneled through me, and then I, you know, parcel them off to Bo or, you know, the guys or Mike at the treatment plant to get those questions answered and put back. Sometimes it actually requires somebody from the city to, you know, put on your boots, go out in the field, go take a look at some stuff, and gather information and send that back to the designers so that we can have a project that's well-rounded, it's well thought out. We've, you know, looked at the various issues to hopefully save us money when we go to construction. So, I feel like I'm rambling.
So it seemed to me, if I was listening carefully at committee and at council, this seems to be the idea coalescing that this would be nice to have, but I think there was interest in the paying for it question. So can we jump to that and then open for more questions? This will cost the city a little bit. I'd like to address that to either to Mr. Rentz or Mr. Peterson, who would like to take it.
I can make an initial comment and then please in the Mark follow-up. You know, as we discussed it at committee, is that the project inspector is, you know, if we look at the full cost of the person, whether it's the, you know, complete cost of the city of salary, benefits, and fully inclusive, it's about $105,000, $107,000, depending on what year we're looking at. We've got annual escalators on our contract, and specifically what salary range we bring the person in at. Of that, we anticipate that about 10% would be not billed out to projects, just for meetings and trainings and, you know, the various things that we do as city employees. 90% of that time would be billable to projects, so whether it's a sewer project, a water project, a stormwater project, a lot of those have the availability of backfilling that with grant funding so that there's less of an impact to the city. The 10% portion would be paid out from the general fund, so that's in that $10,000 to $15,000 a year range. Currently, we're contracting out for a large amount, we're contracting out for all of the amount of the inspections that we're doing with the capital projects. By bringing this person in house, we would be able to see a reduction in that contracted service, and bringing that in house to where we'd be utilizing our own person. And I gave you a cost breakdown over the past 2 years of what we expended on those private inspections, taking out that large Church Road project that was, you know, seen, I thought, as being outside of the scope of what we would have, you know, sent our person out to be the primary inspector on. And we spent $79,014 and $94,015 doing that. So if we looked at, you know, potentially doing about half of the inspections on our projects ourselves, we can, you know, eliminate $50,000 of that. But at the same time, you know, I think that we get a benefit all throughout the year by going through the design phase with the person and being able to have that person that went through the entire design with that project be the person that's out. They already know what's going on with the project. They don't have to be brought up to speed with the project. When you bring in a private inspector with it, they have not had the interaction with that plan set leading up to the day of construction. So it works out to be a better methodology and a cost savings all the way around. And I think Katie could probably illustrate pretty well the cost savings to the city by going out and being able to, you know, look at a project and design it from the beginning. Beginning of a project, you have a great ability to impact the design at very low cost. When you go out to construction, you have very little ability to impact the project at a very large cost. So that ability for us to do that up front is going to be a great benefit. And I don't know if Mark wants to add anything to the breakdown on general versus.
I think our public works director covered all the salient points, assuming a 10% residual staying in the general funds, only like 10, 11, 12 grand, kind of a noise level, if you will.
Councilmember Olson.
I was one of the biggest skeptics, but after sitting in on that meeting and talking to Mark and finding out we have the funding, Kevin, with what it's going to be utilized for, and that we, since we had one of these persons in the past, and when things got bad, we had to lay them off, I'm sure we would do the right thing. I don't like to see people laid off. It's devastating, but hopefully that won't occur again, because that was a recession. So with that in mind, I'd like to move for approval Agenda Bill 1605009.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to hire an inspector, and I'd just like to comment on the intangibles. It's Councilmember Mal Hansen, who was here since about the time the city was called JAM, was paid a few hundred bucks a month, but his longevity and his scope of understanding of the entire city probably saved the city hundreds of thousands of dollars. You'll never see that on the balance book, but I think having a single person that has his scope around all the projects at once, it will bring great benefits to the city, and I think will pay back in good ways. Any more discussion? Councilmember Goodrich.
I was in the same boat as Councilmember Olson on this, that I was really, in a way, opposed to it. Not that you guys don't need the person. You know, it's just the dollars and cents aspect of it and what impact it would have on the city. But again, going through the discussions and the committee discussions, I can see supporting this position now. I hope it really helps you out, Katie.
Thank you, Councilmember. Is Council ready for the question? Mm-hmm. All in favor of the agenda bill to hire an inspector, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. It is passed 7-0, and we shall hire that inspector shortly.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, City Council.
Thank you.
Going on to, I guess I want to call this 502 version point 00, whatever we're at right
Thank
now.
You.
Here we are. Item G, ordinance, emergency moratorium on second retail marijuana store. I believe that our community development director has a presentation for us.
Why is this considered an emergency?
The community development director, Burnett.
Staff is here only to address legal questions. At this point, the city can adopt an emergency moratorium. We've consulted with the city attorney, who said that you are allowed to adopt a moratorium. You have a moratorium in front of you. I think anything else that staff could add at this point would not be at the staff level and would be more as citizens. So I think that
I'd just say, technically, when we adopt an ordinance, it goes into effect after a couple of days. Forget how many days.
Five
days. An emergency moratorium goes into effect as soon as enough people go yes. So I think to answer your question, the purpose of an emergency moratorium is to have it take effect immediately, so there's no time lag where, let's say the moratorium is trying to prevent something from happening. There's no time lag that thing could actually happen before the 5 days runs and it officially becomes law. So that's really the only purpose of the emergency, is it pushes the implementation time to right now.
There's not a sense of danger in the word emergency.
It's a term of art. I wish it wasn't called, because it lends with it some air of, oh my God, you know, my hair's on fire. But no, and what you're really doing is you're preserving the status quo right now. And in this case, you're preventing, if it was to pass, the second store could not be applied for if you pass it tonight. If it was not an emergency moratorium and just a regular moratorium, 5 days would pass before that second store would not be allowed to apply, if that's helpful.
Mr. Burnett, you want to continue?
That's all that I had.
Councilmember Goodrich.
Just to probably some of the audience or students to think. Originally, if I have this right, originally the state allowed us one store. And then the state changed the rules and said Ferndale can have a second store. And then that came before the council. Then the 4-3 was in to allow the second store. Is that? And that's how we got to where we are today.
Correct.
There's basically a change in the policy by the state.
Correct. The voters adopted Initiative 502 back in 2012. Technically, we are only partially associated with I-502 now, because the state then last year combined recreational and medicinal marijuana, so now we are subject to the state's regulations. I-502 got it started. Now we're in accordance with
Public Current Cannabis Board.
Yes.
Councilmember Watson, please.
And just to let everyone know, we actually got emails from three business owners asking us to revisit our decision. And that's something we do. You know, occasionally you'll get an email or someone will come talk to you, someone from the community. And this time we had three business owners who asked us, we know you made this decision in February. Would you consider it, you know, again? And so we brought it forward just to have a discussion. I don't know if anything's going to change, but, you know, it's happened before. We talked about the Metropolitan Park District many, many times. We voted on it at least twice, maybe three times. But that's just what we do. And I know not everybody was happy that we brought it forward again, but people are allowed to ask you, would you mind thinking about it again? And so that's why it's here, to see if you want to think about it again.
Well said. Other councilmembers. Councilmember Birch.
It was 15 weeks ago that we did approve the second store, and it was done by this council, so nothing's changed. But we did get the emails, and I would like to know if any of those business owners are here tonight that sent those emails, because there was no business owner in February when we brought this forward in February.
I'm not sure if there was much notice of this moratorium this evening. That's part of why you have those emergency moratoriums. I don't think the paper being caught wind of council action. They may not have known, is what I'm saying.
Discover Ferndale mentioned it in their lovely article earlier.
Yes.
There you go.
Councilmember Zarr.
So the majority of council did approve a second store only 3 months ago, and I think bringing this back again is crap in a way. We did get the emails from Jake Locker and his business partner. However, I don't hold their opinions over any other citizen, especially those who showed up to our public hearing that was well publicized. A lot of people came out. We heard from both sides. We made an informed decision at that time. So.
Thank you, council member.
I'm not done. Sorry.
Oh, go for it. Well, it's all yours. That's the period there.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Well, yes, I have a second point now.
It's all yours.
So we do have a store in Ferndale. This guy has not fallen. He's been here for 8 months. It's doing well. It's sold about $360,000+ in the past 4 months. So there is a demand in our community for this product. I think allowing a second store versus not, just letting one business have a monopoly here. So I think I oppose this moratorium.
Thank you. Councilmember, well said. Do you have a hand up?
No.
Councilmember Birch.
I just want to add the fact that we are joining the recreational with medical, and there I see a lot of need for the medical aspect here in Ferndale.
Councilmember Watson.
I was hoping that we could limit it to one store. When I signed up to have the medical marijuana and marijuana in general in Ferndale, it was because we were only going to have one store. I guess my concern is always that we would have as many marijuana stores as we do bars. So I'm hoping that's not going to be the case, but I don't know the council has changed their mind. But again, we were asked, and I do think if anyone in this room had asked us to revisit it, I think there's enough of us who would like to revisit it that it would have come forward again. It wasn't just who the people were that sent out that email. Pretty much any one of you could have asked us to do the same thing, and the three people who only want one store would have brought it forward again.
Councilmember Olson.
Rather than have... Everyone has had their say, and it's apparent, no doubt what anybody says. I don't think there's a need for the chief to speak unless you see that. I would be more inclined to, there's only seven of us making this decision. We all have our opinions. Some might change, some might not. I think it would be only fair to put the moratorium on and then throw this to the November ballot for an advisory vote from everyone in the city. Give everyone in the city their opportunity to say it. You could stuff the room with yay-sayers. I could stuff it with nay-sayers. That's really not representative of the whole city. So I would like to see an advisory vote. We checked with the Debbie Adelstein, and putting it on the November ballot would cost maybe $4,000. That's a third of what the Metropolitan Parks cost us.
Councilmember Goodrich.
What bothers me is the fact that the state changing the rules. And this was an issue when it first came up, and we had our first moratorium is because there wasn't a clear set of rules. And then the things keep changing, and it's two stores now. If the state feels that they can get more money out of it, then maybe it'll be three or four stores. And where do we go? Originally it was presented to the city one store, and the time the council, kind of went along with that, even though we don't necessarily want it, but we kind of went along with it because that's what the state and our attorney and stuff was talking about, that we could have the one store. Since then, we found out some other cities have said no stores, and they've kind of gotten away with it, which is what we were told we could do and stuff. So it's because of all these rule changes and policy changes, and you can't do this, but then you can do this and stuff, that I would like this moratorium to go into effect just to see where this continues to go and what we're doing. And I like Councilmember Olson's idea of the advisory vote of the citizens. I don't know if we can do that or look at just use the voting results of the 502 when it was voted on by the city election and say putting it back on the ballot. We have the breakdown of how the city voted for the 502 resolution to begin with. So
that was 50-50.
There's a question in the audience.
Yeah, so I kind of like that idea of putting the moratorium on and then going for the advisory vote. Because like you said, we've had this in the past. We had it with the double dome thing where somebody rigged the voting, and so we ended up with a pool on the top of one of our lists to do things because the audience was rigged. So
I'm happy to go to the audience, but council, any other questions and comments from the city council?
I'd like to wait until we have our comment here.
Mrs. Goldsmith.
Good evening, council. I'm Yvonne Goldsmith. I live at 5840 Church Road, and I serve on the Planning Commission. And if my memory serves me right, we were told that we had to vote on this marijuana store thing. Then about a week or two later, it was like the state kind of changed their mind. Exactly what you're saying, Councilmember Goodrich. And so now the state's telling you can have two stores in Ferndale. And then next year when we have a shortfall, guess what? You can have three stores because the state finds it as another little tax source or money bag. And I'd really like you to really think about this before you go in and just keep adding, because the state cannot give clear direction and keep their word.
Thank you, Mrs. Goldsmith. Council would need four votes. Please come forward. We're glad to have you. Introduce yourself and where you live.
Hi, I'm Michelle Gallegos. I live up on Church Road. And I was actually here for that meeting, and there was businesses that were here that wanted that second store. I'm not quite sure, but does the city not get any money from the taxes off of the recreation store?
Mr. Peterson, revenue.
We do indeed get not only regular sales tax, which we have been seeing coming in, we also get a bigger tax, which we haven't seen a nickel of that yet. It's promised. So the city does get general fund monies. Yep.
Okay. And so this one store that we do have is doing good, I hear. And I know that at the last meeting he didn't want a second store. Of course, nobody wants competition in the town. I feel there is a need and there is a want and a desire for a second store. And then it could be beneficial, especially with all of these projects that we have coming up that we're looking for funds for. Like the first gentleman said about business, bring business here. And it helps to provide what we want here as a city. So that's just something to think about.
Thank you for coming to us. And it seems like the first store owner actually spoke positively of a second store, but that's just by memory. So, but it doesn't much matter, but still a good point.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
City Council, what is your pleasure? Councilmember Olson.
I would like to propose a moratorium for propose a moratorium go forward and with a request a citywide vote with the November election and let the citizens decide whether we have a second store, third store, or 10 stores.
So is that a motion for the moratorium, which would be enacted immediately, and discussion on, or is it the motion to actually have the ballot?
Well, that would be, yes, because we're going to beat this thing to death. Why don't we give the citizens of the city the ultimate say, yes or no?
I wait a second.
I'll second it.
It's been moved and seconded to pass a moratorium and to put this on the ballot in an advisory vote in November. Is that the motion? It's been moved and seconded. Mr. Peterson.
Kind of not my area, but question would be, the moratorium, would we be able to sustain the moratorium until the November election?
Yeah. There's a requirement for a public hearing because of the emergency nature, but Yuri can talk about that.
And we all, I think, as staff had the same questions. You can re-up a moratorium more than once. You do have to have a public hearing within a certain period of time. I believe it's 90 days where you have to adopt findings of fact.
60 days,
I'm sorry. But, yes, you can re-up it for additional time to get you through November.
Yeah, moratoriums can be for 6 months. Well, I should say, an emergency moratorium, you have to have a hearing within 60 days, findings of fact. It can be for 6 months renewable, right, or it could be for up to a year if you have a work plan.
Well, 6 months would carry us past the election.
And again, it could be cities do this. You can do 6 months and then re-up it for another 6 months, and you know,
well, there
logically, you do want to bring it to a conclusion.
Well, we would by having the vote in early November.
Exactly.
Councilor, can I ask a couple questions? I'm assuming, but I want to make sure, this is not an advisory vote to close any existing
businesses. No, this is just to...
And is this pertaining to all 502 businesses, grower processors, and retail, or just retail? Just clarification.
We could add that. If you go by what the news just had, the state says we have more than enough processor growers, and they're not issuing licenses. That could change tomorrow, so you're right.
Okay. So this is a stop right here where we're at with 502 businesses. And just wanted to be sure.
Correct.
So what the motion is, and is that what you understood as well? Councilmember Watson.
Clarification from staff. As I understand advisory votes, they have no power. Is it? Yeah. Because the legislature sends advisory votes to us once a year, and they don't mean anything. So.
And there have been several advisory votes recently in the state, and they have gone against 502 growth, but they're not binding exactly.
Yeah, not
Mr. Burnett,
may I ask a clarification and make a clarification as well? I believe that the moratorium language that we have proposed thus far can be amended to include that. Obviously, the clarification request I would have is for the one retailer that we have right now who I believe is seeking a medical endorsement and has already initiated the paperwork, would that apply to them as far as them not being able to move to medical as of July 1st of this year?
That was not my intent.
Okay.
I thought they already had been approved for medical. They were gonna,
they have. The
they've already been approved for medical.
They just can't start until July.
So by unanimous consent, we're not including this particular situation in this moratorium. Thing move
Riley
forward.
There was
Mr. Sweeney.
Thank you. There was a dispute earlier about the 502 vote within the city limits of Ferndale. I just ran the numbers on it. Of the over 5,000 people who voted in the city limits of Ferndale on that particular vote, it was the noes had it by a mere 119 votes. So it was really close.
50-50.
But
thank you, Mr. Sweeney. Big vote, folks.
That was close as the mayor's race.
Thank you. Any more discussion from City Council? Councilmember Hansen.
I would just say that drawing the line at one store versus two it seems like an arbitrary line to me. We've already opened the door, and a second store isn't going to make a significant difference. And personally, I feel like it's up against the historical trajectory that's headed in a different direction. Two more states in July. Make it bank recreational marijuana legal, and if my research is correct, we've just crossed over 25 states that allow medical marijuana.
history is pushing us in a different direction. And I feel like this is just an arbitrary line in the sand.
Thank you, council member. Council, are you ready for the vote? This is a vote on a moratorium and to take an to present an advisory vote on 502 expansion in Ferndale in November. And our city clerk will do a roll call vote, please.
Councilmember Goodrich.
Are voting for the moratorium?
Yes, you are.
Okay. Yes.
Councilmember Starr.
No.
Councilmember Gersh.
No.
Councilmember Hansen.
No.
Councilmember Watson.
Yes.
Councilmember Olson.
Yes.
Councilmember Taylor.
At 3-4, it has failed. The moratorium has not passed. And I want to thank council for a very civil discussion. I appreciate it very much. I want to thank Councilmember Olson for bringing this back. And next item of business, City Council, is, here we are, comp plan amendment. Now that we're all wide awake and we still have students here, they're okay for another 15 minutes. Mr. Burnett.
Should be done by then, hopefully. So, Yuri Burnett. Yuri Burnett, Community Development Director. The Capital Facilities element is the last major element of the comprehensive plan to be considered. It'll be adopted or scheduled to be adopted on June 20th. So we wanted to run this by you to get your last impressions before we send it back to the Planning Commission. So the capital facilities element is the element that addresses our water, sewer, stormwater, parks, and city buildings. It also includes references to the fire district and the school district. And actually, should we turn off this slide as well, or would it get too dark?
Thank you.
It also includes the fire district and the school district. While they are our partners, we do not have direct oversight over those two districts. I'm going to rush through this a little bit, not rush through it, but just hit the high points, because this PowerPoint is actually the accompanying multimedia presentation that would be adopted with this. So similar to what we've talked about with transportation, we have level of service standards for our various capital facilities. And they vary from capital facility to capital facility. By and large, a lot of our level of service have been outdated to a certain extent, where, for instance, with our buildings, which is my favorite one to talk about, we say that our city buildings are going to have enough room for 300 feet for each staff person. So what you basically do is you take all the staff that are employed by the city, you add up all the different buildings that the city owns, including the library, including the PD, including the shops, some of which aren't available to the public, and you divide by 300, and if you have additional space, you're good to go. You can add more staff. If you don't, then in theory, you have to add more buildings. What we found, this is a good case of why level of service needs to reflect what you're actually wanting to measure. We've got adequate space based on that, but we don't have buildings that actually work the way that we expect them to. So as we work with David King through the rest of the summer, it'll be adopted after the comprehensive plan, we expect to come up with better, more understandable measurements of how we evaluate success for our buildings. And it might mean that we do need to build new buildings. It might mean that we need to reconsider the way that we do evaluate success. But we do have a couple of other levels of service that are more straightforward. For instance, parks, we say it's measured as distance to residents or distance from residents. So you don't need to drive 10 minutes to get to a park in Ferndale, where you might as well then drive up to Linden or down to Bellingham. Fire services is based on response time, which is probably what you would expect as well. And again, we do want them to be realistic and measurable. There are a variety of different levels of service. And as I said, we are working on a building analysis where we expect that to come soon. Overall, just stepping back a little bit, for our various capital facilities, similar to transportation, we look at all the projects that are going to be necessary and we assign a price tag to that. And then we look based on our connection fees, based on our billing statements, based on available grants and other things, whether or not we think we're going to be able to pay for those capital facilities. Our current proposed plan is not markedly different from our existing plan. The things that we expect to do as far as water and sewer really makes sense, and we do need to do them. If we have a plant that can only serve this many people, we don't have much choice. We need to expand our plant. The numbers that we're seeing, we believe that we're going to be able to afford the costs over the next 20-year period. Yes, it might mean in some cases increases in some fees, but it's not exorbitant. It's not what anything we haven't planned for. It is sustainable.
Yeah, I would concur with you.
You would concur with that. So that's a big deal and a big conclusion, that we believe that we can afford these things, and that you as holding the purse strings, that's a kind of sigh of relief perhaps, where we're not talking about all of a sudden a $250 million price tag for your facilities.
Yeah, and I mean,
because we would just laugh if you did that.
I know.
Yeah, and you know, more with the capital facilities element and the project lists that are included for water, sewer, storm, you know, they're really a needs-driven list. It's not the roadway driven by capacity and others. It's a little bit, you know, less interesting to look at, but more kind of nuts and bolts decision-making process on where we need to have, you know, either address capacity issues or condition issues, so... It's kind of one of those lists that it is what it is.
And because that is what it is, and because the buildings are coming up later, we get to talk a little bit about parks. Because parks are one that, as you know, tend to be seen by many as a, if you have additional money, let's spend it on parks. If you don't, it's the first to be cut. It's a want, not a need, is the perspective of many. And practically speaking, that is what happens. When you're in a recession or a depression, parks are one of the first things that are cut. So what we have right now in our parks plan that was just adopted in 2013 is a measurement based on distance, where the projects that end up coming out, again, we said you get what you measure, are things that reduce that distance. So that means that our new parks plan or our existing parks plan really emphasizes trails and trail projects and de-emphasizes a lot of new parks. So does that for a couple of reasons. Trails are easier to maintain. Trails are used by a potentially greater percentage of the population, where that's an easy thing to do, whereas parks quite often, if a park that is close to you doesn't have the amenities that you want, you're going to go elsewhere. Whereas a trail, it's an evening stroll, it's a place to walk the dog, it's a place where the kids to run, where they know that a park is at the end of it. So the projects that we're looking at, we have tried to emphasize the gaps that we have in our existing plan, or where we already have trails or sidewalks on either side, but we don't have a park. This doesn't really make too much sense. It's some red lines on screen, but when you add in our interconnection, which is basically looking at
doesn't take much.
Vista, Thornton, Shannon, and then using Lego in the old Mountain View school, we have our inner connection. The outer connection also utilizes a lot of our sidewalks, but then has some cool things like the boardwalk down to Pioneer, the expansion of the Riverwalk connection to Vander Yacht. It takes into account possibly utilizing around the periphery of the Ferndale School District properties to create that link. And then we have other, this is Meadows and other developments going forward, Portal as part of our Portal projects that we've talked about, and then going up and utilizing Thornton and Griffintown and then linking up that way. Since a lot of it is sidewalks, we are allowed to then combine some of our projects together, our transportation projects, maybe even water sewer, in some cases, maybe even stormwater, so that we bring those costs down. For the capital projects, where we can even in some cases do work parties to close a gap, similar to what we did at Primrose Lane a couple of years ago. The issue, though, is we continue to potentially build parks and trails, but we continue to fall farther and farther behind in terms of maintenance. where right now we have 2 full-time Parks employees, mm-hmm. but Parks and Trails equal 35% of our crew's time, and we are just simply not funding maintenance and operations.
Yeah, about the equivalent of 6 FTEs, I think, when you factor in the summer employment there. We utilize the crew for backfilling, doing mowing during the growing season that we're in right now. And so there's a significant amount of time that the crew is working on those parks, trying to keep things up. You know, we've had some vandalism and maintenance issues with the fountain downtown, some vandalism issues with the picnic structures and electrical getting ripped out of things. And so, you know, it's that we have a you know, 2 dedicated parks employees, and you think about, oh, well, we've got parks, we have these 2 people, but it actually encompasses a much greater effort from the city crews to be able to maintain the standard that we see in our parks right now. And those costs are kind of hidden away. They're not really seen as, like, oh, you know, a parks thing, because it's not called out as a specific.
This is not information. It might be packaged in a little bit differently, but it's not information that you haven't heard. When we were talking about the Parks District, that died for a number of different reasons that you're all familiar with. But the fact is, we realize that we're talking about needing to create new money here, probably, or to take money from something that is probably perceived by many, and they might be right, as being more critical as far as life safety or delivery of water or sewer, or again, expanding the pie in some ways, and whether that is adding money to the general fund, a parks district, the greenways, or whatever. What happened last time, I think, is we did not hear from Public Works or from staff so much as we heard from the Parks Board, which is great. The fact is that the crew is stretched, and we're starting to see, well, we might not be seeing, and that might be part of the issue.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things, is that as the Parks Department was, you know, taken down in staffing level, the Public Works crews took up the slack in that. And, you know, when you go around town and you visit the parks, you know, present, like, growing season excluded mostly, the lawns are mowed and the parks look good, and that's a credit to the Public Works crew and the Parks Department staff that works diligently to keep those facilities up to that standard. But by utilizing the Public Works crew, it takes away from the work that they normally do. And so when we talk about, you know, things like going through and doing the water flush in town, well, if we need to pull a person off of that to go mow a park, then that slows down the progress of the water flush around town. One of the projects that we'd like to do is smoke testing of the sewers around the city, but that has been deferred over a number of years because of the workload that has been, you know, taken up by other aspects of their scope. So it's, you know, going back to trying to get that dedicated parks and putting that back on the parks is, instead of taking away from the staff time and the Public Works crew.
So leaving parks and just going through these things real quick, because we can come back to parks. We do have in the document a number of different infographics where we tried to really quickly, because things are going according to plan, tried to just give a thumbnail sketch of them. Perhaps water stands a little bit apart, where this is a change since the last time, where we did switch from the PUD water to well water, and so this is going to be the first comprehensive plan that identifies it. Towards the end of the planning period, we are going to need to look at expanding
additional well capacity within the system, and that's something we're continuing to evaluate. At Public Works is looking at, you know, right now we're utilizing 2 wells, withdrawing from 1 portion of the aquifer. We're engaged in a consolidation effort where we're taking all of the city's water rights and consolidating them into 1 pool of water rights. We'd be able to take multiple points of withdrawal within a geographically defined area within the aquifer. So we're investigating drilling further wells at the sites that we have, whether it be the Douglas site or the city shop site, to provide redundancy with those wells, as well as expanding the geographical area that we're withdrawing water from within the aquifer. So branching out and doing well at another location within the city, and then incorporating the Central City Water Rights in as well, and dealing with the point of withdrawal for that.
And fire district, library, and again, we do anticipate, and we're going to update this perhaps a little bit, that we will be able to fund these things as far as capital is concerned. It does come back, and there will be tough choices over the next 20 years in some areas, but as far as the maintenance and operations, especially of parks, is where we are seeing deficiency, in addition to buildings, which we will see later on this year. So, are there any questions?
Council, questions of staff. Councilmember Watson.
So with parks, how much money would you need a year to go through and fix all the equipment? Because in our HOA, once a year, we basically repaint all the equipment, make sure all the toys are working.
I have not performed an analysis, although Riley looks like he's got something for the Parks Board.
Yes. If this fascinates you, our per-tab board is conducting a parks audit, and we will have the results of that not this meeting, but next meeting. So
it would help me to know, because we talk about how much do you need, but do you need, if you had $50,000 a year, would that be enough to make sure that everything got painted and we didn't have all this rusty equipment like we have now? Or do you need 100, or do you need 150?
So we hope to get that information to you next
month. Good question, though. Councilmember Olson.
You said we're going to get an inventory.
The Parks Board is just conducting an audit of the current state of all of our parks.
Okay,
we're taking a lot of pictures.
That's not what next council meeting says.
No, just next month we will have completed the audit. It's not.
You probably can't see what I'm seeing.
He's looking at the picture.
June 6th, it says Park District Formation Discussion.
Not connected to that. Not connected.
So that's something different.
Are we doing that June 6th? I thought we weren't even going to do it in committee until the middle of June.
Yeah, I think these things tend to be flexible.
Yes. They're written stone to us. If you said June 6th, I've got all.
Well, I just wonder why we would Park District Formation Discussion. We've already had this.
Yeah, a lot of times.
We've already thrown this out.
Yeah.
$12,000, we found out they didn't want it.
Hey, buddy, we had the marijuana conversation, too.
Well, if we follow that line of thinking, why is this on here?
Okay, Council. Questions of staff on capital facilities update?
I have none.
Thank you. Any other questions? I think, Ms. Goldsmith.
My gum's getting to work on
Yvonne. Yvonne Goldsmith, 5840 Church Road. At the Planning Commission last week, when you already did the presentation, I brought up a question. I realized that the state legislature, they set the impact fees, and where builders and developers have to come in and pay X amount of money and either put a park in or... Why can't we, you, the council, is there some way to override that where if... this new development comes in and there's a park over here with a trail, why did they have to put another park in, which cost us, the city? Why can't they just put some money towards the park's budget for maintenance?
Yeah.
You know, it's just an idea that I threw out that I really think is valid. Why did they have to continue? I mean, we are putting in, I am so excited about Star Park. I'm there for 5 days, all three shifts, okay, because I believe in it. Now, I also worked on the Parks District vote no thing, okay? But why can't developers, instead of having to build a park that has to be maintained, it has to go through vandalism, blah, 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 why can't they just put money into a fund, a dedicated fund, to maintain the parks in the city of Ferndale? Why can't we have that as an option? That's my question.
Mr. Burnett, you want to tackle parts of that?
Parts of it, I like.
Park impact fees, state mandated.
So RCW 82.02.020 is.
I want someone to look it up. Make sure he's not making that up.
It is associated. They clearly state that it shall be for growth related projects and not for maintenance. So. Whatever the history is, someone asked it and answered, I guess, by the legislature. But whether or not the city could say, I don't know, as far as
we know. I guess the one thing that I would say would be that, you know, that methodology of charging a developer to come in and pay an impact fee with it is a one-time fee. And so if we, you know, go to the developer and say, you know, $100 of the cost of building the house goes towards maintenance of the parks, we only get that one time, whereas the, you know, it's an ongoing expenditure. And with that, too, I mean, the development of an additional park is a one-time expenditure. But I think that I would assume that the intent of the fee is much like our traffic impact fees, is to ensure that, you know, as we move forward in time, that there are opportunities for parks to be constructed in locations where development is occurring, rather than just having parks in old, well-established neighborhoods where they were, you know, historically located, and nothing in the new developments leading to sprawl and no activity for the kids to, you know, be able to do something. So I think that, you know, the intent is to provide that opportunity for every citizen, and like our parks plan indicates, is that we're looking to have a park located within a certain geographical distance from each person, that the person that lives in a development out of the Meadows has the ability to go to a park just like the person does living on Portal Way. So,
and the audience should know that we do have park fees, that every developer knows that we have park fees, which we modified a few times based on the level of a service, which used to be acreage, now it's distance.
Exactly.
We changed a bit. It's about $1,500 a home, somewhere in that
or so,
ballpark.
Yeah. The other thing I was going to just add is we have our impact fees, and then we have SEPA, the State Environmental Policy Act. If we were a city where we were seeing housing developments of 1,000 units at a time, or if we saw a regional mall or something, conceivably, we could, through SEPA, require a more permanent mitigation measure to say there is demonstrable evidence that by adding 1,000 new homes at this location, that you will require, you're adding a 12th to our population, so you will, for the next 10 years, pay for the costs of an additional worker. We, to a certain extent, are adept by 1,000 cuts, where we're freaking out because we have the possibility of 157 units. It's their impacts are distributed so much that we can't use SEPA to have a more permanent.
Thank you, Mr. Moran. Council, that is the end of discussion, I believe, on our capital facilities. And I think that gets us to the end of the meeting. Mayor Report, just mentioned briefly, one of my absolute favorite citizens is here, Mrs. McKay. I see her walking from her home up Top Church Road down to the city all the time. She's going to outlive all of us. But what she does, she picks up the garbage. So she would insist, and I would agree, that Church Road and Main Street are probably the cleanest streets in town, which makes a nice segue, because the next 2 weeks is a focus on cleaning up the city of Ferndale. Riley came up with the phrase Ferndale Fresh. I like Ferntastic, but you get the idea. So clean up your neighborhood and come down on Saturday. All City Cleanup Day, I think it starts at 9 o'clock. Bertella Hansen says you need to do that. So that's all you need to hear, is Bertella says to be there.
I'll be
right, there you are. Of course you are. Greg's been there. Greg has been there since he was a little guy, which was a long time ago. Also coming up on a great weekend, the Memorial Day weekend begins Friday with the dedication of Dick Stone and Joe Mosier Street. That's at 12:30. And that's ended up being a very big event. That is almost too big, but probably not. The weekend comes up with the Ski to Sea weekend. Everybody wants to observe some of that. And then, of course, all the festivities on Memorial Day. So that's all the stuff that the mayor has. Council reports.
There's something going on after that week, too.
We'll get to it.
Spoilers.
We'll get to them. Councilmember Goodrich.
Just some updates from the fire district meeting. I've already talked to the public works director about this, but I got beat up pretty well over the Washington Street project and how it's going to impact the fire station, the crosswalk, the narrowing of the street, a whole bunch of stuff like that they have concerns about, and I've already passed that on. But I told them I would be their voice to the council to let them know that they are not happy campers over this project. The other thing that was interesting is they're ordering a brand new ambulance, and I didn't realize how much our ALS units are, but a new ambulance is $175,000, and they'll order it now and they won't take delivery until next year. It's like 8 to 10 months from the time you order an ambulance to the time it shows up there. But they put 50,000 miles a year on their aid units, approximately. And that's serving in Ferndale and all the Whatcom 7 fire district. A lot of aid calls that they go out on and things. So I just wanted to share that little bit of information. So that they're also ordering a new fire engine. I think that's $250,000, $250,000 for the new fire engine.
Thank you, Councilmember Goodrich. Other council members with reports? Quiet bunch. We'll go on to staff, City Administrator Greg Young, who's going to take a little break here.
Yeah, just want to report, last Thursday and Friday I was in Seattle for a two-day eminent domain condemnation conference, and it is a commentary on my life, but I found it very exciting.
You really seized the material.
There's a small circle of attorneys and appraisers that do condemnation work. The gentleman we use for all of our right-of-way condemnation eminent domain work is probably the preeminent person in the Pacific Northwest. His firm does all of the right-of-way work for Sound Transit, and so his firm's been a little busy digging tunnels and buying right-of-way for stations. But one excellent aspect of the conference was that one of the speakers was Senator Curtis King, who's the chairman of the Senate Transportation Committee, and he was instrumental in helping the city get some money for Thornton this year. So I spent a little bit of time with him. We had a very nice visit, and I passed on the gratitude of the thankful city, and let him know that we plan on spending the money wisely, and he appreciated that. So he was a popular guy during the legislative session. Now the hard work of actually spending the money. I thought it was a fascinating conference. Aloha Motel featured highly when it came to blighted properties. And so that was a good case study to see how bad things have to get before cities are able to take and condemn, buy, repurpose, and then sell these blighted properties. So I know even when I say it, it sounds ridiculous, but I found it interesting and well worth the time.
Of course you would.
I am.
Communications officers, Weenie.
When we gather here next,
I think a funeral is going to happen.
We will have built the Star Park, but it's not going to happen. That's what I'm communicating to you. It's not going to happen unless more people step up. So, all of you have committed quite a bit to volunteering, to donating, and that's fantastic. But you all have two more people in your Rolodex, provided you still use one. I'm looking at you, Keith. You all have... I'm hip. You all have at least two more people that you can ask, can you do one shift?
You're assuming we have friends.
I am. You're all elected officials. You have friends of some sort. You can all ask two people this week, because we're only at 61% of the volunteer shifts filled. And that's freaking me out. It's not going to get built unless people step up. So now I'm going to turn my ever-restful gaze this way. All of you can volunteer for shifts, too. There's a meal involved. It's going to be a lot of fun. cityofferndale.org/starpark. I will see you all signed up tonight. Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
We're going to build the largest playground in the city of Ferndale. We're going to do it in 1 week, and it's going to happen.
Thank you, Mr. Sweeney.
Stay all day. There's three meals.
City Clerk Susan Duncan, please.
Yep.
Mr. Burnett, Community Development. Mr. Renz. City Treasurer, Mr. Pearson.
Yep.
And Chief of Police, Michael Knapp, in the back. Very good. I will entertain a motion to dismiss.
So moved.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.